working on to be announced.
So what I'll talk about is effective action for bribery. But before I do that, I just want to make a small comment with regard to Jens Niepeyer's talk today. He was looking at this quantum cosmology scenario where you thought the universe was nothing, and then one of the nice features of this scenario, however believable you may think it is, that it sort of predicts what the initial conditions are for their fluctuations. And so, with some joint work with Sasha Renji, Gary Schmidt, and Peter Lewis-Harvey, we've also been looking at this somewhat along the ideas that Jens was proposing. And one of the things he mentioned is that all these stories rely heavily on the superspace approximation. And roughly speaking, this is not exactly, in a very simple version, or in the sort of the simplest standard Markov version, the reason why you can predict the initial conditions for the fluctuations is simply the fact that you impose the supersymmetries. I mean that that's part of the superspace approximation. If you analytically continue that, it becomes the instanton that tunnels from nothing. You have a sphere that has four. And then and then the initial conditions that they're picked are just the ones that preserve regularity of the wave function at the south pole. Okay, so this is how the initial conditions are selected out of the all possible choices of the solution for the equation of motion. However, if you go beyond the decoherence, what actually turns out is that beyond mean superspace, so the particular scenario that Sasha Renji and the Cornell group worked on was a scenario called decoherence. What it basically means is if you look precisely at some of these tunneling amplitudes, it means that you can't make a mean superspace approximation. If the other fluctuations influence the tunneling rate, and they influence precisely the solution to the field equations that you're using. And what actually happens is that the solution starts to deviate from pure sitter. It becomes effectively a universe that looks like a sitter plus radiation. And the point is, if you analytically continue to sitter plus radiation, you don't get a nice S4, you get a barrel geometry, which has just that its south pole is logged off. So there's clearly what happens is that there's no obvious regularity condition to impose anymore. So if you go beyond mini superspace, one of the nice features of this scenario that it predicts the initial condition for fluctuations seems to go out the window. So this will hopefully come out in the next month. There are some nice features, though, which I'm not going to talk about, but actually this is a very special universe, the sitter plus radiation. It turns out it's one of the few universes where you can compute the exact power spectrum of fluctuations. So you don't have some slow roll or anything.
What do you mean exact? Independently of the initial conditions?
No, it means that the wave equation for the fluctuation is a known equation. There's no solutions. Like a pure sitter or power law, you get exact Hadley functions. But in a generic case, right, or in the slow roll, you can make a Bessel function approximation. But in a generic universe, you don't know what the solution to the wave equation is.
So it's exactly computed, but
then. And in the sitter plus radiation exact is one of these special situations where it's an exactly.
But then no.
Yeah, it's the Lamé equation.
No, but he means the answer. There is no definite answer.
Because you said...
Go ahead.
Sorry.
It's your question.
Maybe you said it
there is no definite answer because you have to now specify some kind of initial conditions.
You still have the initial conditions.
Yeah.
So normally the power spectrum has an initial condition dependence and it's a slow roll approximation, the double approximation. The last part you don't have. You only have an initial condition.
I thought you had the initial condition when the stuff leaked out at the tunneling.
Excuse me?
I thought that the initial condition was supplied because the stuff leaks out after the tunneling and you have the tunneling model.
Yes, so that's what I said here.
Yeah, right. So, in this case,
the point is, in this case, that doesn't happen.
In this case, that doesn't happen. Yeah, there's no regularity.
One question, just. One is your question. Technically, did you implement this radiation by periodicity and time of some sort that was assumed on the instanton, or was it somehow modeled as actually just a path of radiation?
No, actually what you do is you literally take, you try to compute the instanton solution, basically what is the path through space that is taken, right? And given also the contribution, the back reaction basically from the other mode.
As a form of stress tensor?
Yes, I mean, but you do it in the action. I can show you papers, I'm not the expert on it, but that's what you do.
Can I ask, although we're complaining about the initial condition, is there a sense in which it's weakly, the final answer is weakly dependent on the initial condition? That I'll get, you know, that somehow it's damped out in the tunneling?
No,
not in your approach.
I mean, this is free field theory at the end of the day, so everything about initial condition just stays forever. You would say sort of that you have a growing mode and a damping mode, or whatever you put in a damping mode, doesn't matter. But basically, the Wronskian tells you that you always.
So that growing mode plays a crucial role.
Well, the growing mode is the one that you measure at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But the initial conditions mix the two, and it just stays with you for that. If you have some interactions, then there will be scenarios where it the dependence can go away. Okay, so that was just a brief comment. Now I will continue my talk. So my talk is on purpose a little bit sketchy to provoke discussion. So please do not hesitate to interrupt me when you have a question. Here we go. Okay, so the first thing I want to simply emphasize is that why are we all interested in this question of natural UV cutoffs for gravity, or in this case, effect of action for gravity, is the fact that there is a large amount of cosmological data being gathered, being analyzed, and will be analyzed in the future. And the main part of that is the linear matter power spectrum, which is you here, which is the seeds of all structure. It's basically sort of the distribution of energy density of galaxies or temperature fluctuations in the universe. And the point is that there is really a large amount of data over six orders of magnitude, and there are three different complementary experiments. So the amount of data that is being gathered is quite large. And it means that the projected accuracy, with which sort of idealized accuracy with which one hopes to determine some of the cosmological parameters, is actually rather small, 10 to the minus 6. And if you simply take a very, sort of your first model of inflation that you write down, the scale of inflation that you find over the Planck scale is roughly of order 10 to the minus 5. So this would suggest that maybe sort of corrections of high scale physics will affect data to the level of accuracy that will be measured in the future. And this is, of course, the really important point why this is a question that we should really worry about. I'm going to need to note one interesting thing is that in cosmology, when you talk about early times, this is usually corresponds with large scale. And what we're going to try to do is, and late times correspond to very small-scale features in cosmology. And what we're going to try and do is build effective field theories that can give in a controlled way what are the first-order corrections to the standard cosmological computations. And I just want to note at the outset, by the way, that this is counterintuitive to effective field theory expectations. And effective field theory, or red effective field theory, is precisely sort of the small scales that correspond also to small times, and large scales correspond to large times, which is roughly the Lorentzian variant. So you have an issue, and we will see later that this will come back to haunt us.
Before you go, that ratio approximately 10 to the minus 5.
Yes.
Is the statement in in an optimistic universe, we could hope that it's that big, or do you want to say that?
Roughly speaking, yeah. I mean, you could easily build low-scale inflationary scenarios where age inflation is tiny, well, I mean, tiny, a couple
much
of TV,
yeah.
And then there's zero, okay. no hope. But there are many scenarios, and sort of the most straightforward scenarios do have age that is relative. Okay, so the aim is to write some effective action that can compute some of these corrections. And the reason why I might want to write on effective action is that it really is a controlled way to describe the theoretical error. Plus, it gives you the predictability. The whole theory is expressed in a finite number of undetermined parameters. Once you fix them once, all other experiments you can determine in those. And the way it does it is basically it identifies, or it's a very natural framework to identify the small parameter, and what is the stuff that you ignore. And it's basically consistent up to arbitrary precision in this parameter. It's just a Taylor series. If you want to go beyond the scale parameter, you need really a UV completion. You need more information about physics to describe physics beyond that, but that's not... The nice part about effective actions is that you don't actually need to know that. You simply write down an action as a sort of simple preset as a sum of all kinds of operators that which are classified by their scaling dimension and all that are allowed by the symmetries that you have in your theory. So you introduce then this extra scale M to make the action dimensionless, and the operators are naturally divided into three sets. There are relevant operators, where we're normalizable in old language, and there are marginal renormalizable operators. These you must always take with you. But then the interesting ones for the story here are the so-called irrelevant or non-renormalizable operators, where the coupling constant has negative dimension. And the point is that it's precisely these that correspond sort of the corrections in this small parameter.
So, do you assume locality for quantities of elements?
These are local operators.
Why?
The action is guaranteed to be local in my construction. If you have a non-local term, that basically, in the current understanding, it means that you've integrated out of the degree of freedom, right? Which can arise as an asymptotic state in your theory. So basically, it means you have not correctly identified all the degrees of freedom in your theory that exist below that scale. So you have to if you have non-local terms, you have to reinvestigate the principles from the start. You must know the fields in your theory to write down this action. If you have non-local terms, you should add extra fields, right, which when integrated out give the non-local terms.
So how do you know the set of fields?
Okay, that's a good question.
But it's a question now.
Yeah. So you don't know. So that's a phenomenological thing. But what are the physical principles underlying effective actions? This will again be very important in the context of gravity. First is simply decoupling. We know that physics at very widely separated scales does not influence each other in the first order. And that's the idea that you can decouple the physics at this very high scale M from the physics that you measure at the scale E. What this is implicit in this statement is the energy conservation, that you have a very well-defined notion of what your scales are.
I have a question. If the fundamental objects in your theory are not particles, but strings or something,
yes.
Then is there something that breaks down?
Because
we don't have then fields as a fundamental quantum object.
That is a good question. If you would have a macroscopic, so at scales which are larger than the sizes of the strings, right? You can again.
Yeah, I'm looking at scales smaller than
If you want to describe a theory at the scale of the strings, then it means this wouldn't work. So this is based on the particle light.
So can I ask another question? Can those operators be state dependent? But it depends on the state of the higher degrees of freedom. Because if you integrate over the degrees of freedom, and if all these guys are not in the vacuum state, the operator they will induce might be state dependent. Should be state.
No, the operator is not state dependent, right?
In case of the rapid degrees of freedom, which are not in the vacuum state.
Yes. Well, that's a very good question.
I would think that.
But I'm going to come to that. This is a very good question. Okay. So, if you have if you have very bad time variation in your background, right, then the effect of action actually becomes cool. You really need a nice decoupling of scales. You have very rapid variation, you don't have that. So, there are lots of details that I'm sort of glossing over here. But the point is that what I want to emphasize is here that it's behind this decoupling of scales is a notion of energy conservation or food thinking. And of course, what happens in gravity is that will not be the case. Still, gravity, as we conveniently treated, it has a coupling constant in negative dimension. So, in the sense of before, it has an irrelevant operator. But even though this is non-normalized in the normal sense, you can still consistently describe all the physics below the Planck scale. We do this every day in our general relativity theory course and in cosmology. And if you want to go beyond that scale, you really need a UV completion of that theory. Now, I'm not going to discuss anything about UV completion, except that you know that it's very difficult to construct UV completions of gravity. And there are some hints, in fact, that this UV completion of gravity is unique in a classified sense. Perhaps for those of you who know it, a simple insight maybe is that in the ABS CFT correspondence, which is a duality between gravity and gauge theories, the ultraviolet part of the gravity is related to the infrared part of the gauge theory. We know from standard where the standard quantum field theory, that the infrared parts of the theory are described by a finite number of parameters. So there's a very small subset of your degrees of freedom that is possible. The corollary is that the infrared part of gravity is given by the UV of the gauge theory, and we know lots about the parts of gauge theories. And I wanted to keep this in mind for the second part. So the point was that the axiom energy is conserved doesn't always hold in gravity. There's no clean separation of scales. Well, if you have a space-time background with a time-like Hilling vector, then there is a notion of a conserved quantum number energy. And indeed, it works if you write down the fact of that. And also, if you have sort of space-times which are very slowly changing in the background, to answer Renaud's question earlier, it also seems to work. And it even works if you think of sort of what happens to mode creation or sort of the high energy modes that are being redshifted that start out beyond the CLM and come in. It works if you sort of let them enter in the adiabatic ground state. Now all these words like mode creation and enter always makes me very scary because they already give some preconceived notion of what happens previously. So I don't. I'll use them just to communicate. I don't think you should put any existential meaning to those words.
So I didn't understand why, in this setup, you've used energy conservation. I see that you've used the absence of strong time dependence in external fields.
Okay, so energy conservation in this sense specifically means that if I have a scale, an energy scale, right? That notion will be the same throughout my universe. Time in these space time and if you have an evolving universe or time like Hilling vector, then that's not the case. So that's the simple and it really enters if you go through the formal derivation of effective action. It doesn't enter explicitly in computation, but it's implicit in a step
that is often sort of done in a footnote. And I will come to that in later. I'll explain what that step is. So the point is actually what I want to emphasize and where I want to go is that all these things work as an effective action, but the whole idea of an effective action is that you identify a small parameter and have a controlled quantifiable expansion. So in all these cases where it works, we really want to know what is a small parameter. It's not sort of the standard energy sphere. So if you think of these adiabatically evolving space-times or adiabatic parametric fluctuations, you should expect some kind of quantitatively controlled expansion in adiabatic parameter. In the same way that in flat space you have a quantitatively controlled expansion of the RAM. And that's really the theory what you look for, and that's the effective theory, which is the template against which you can compare cosmological measurements. So that is the goal, this is the motivation. Now I would like to describe sort of two attempts at some of these goals, where we want to go. So let's briefly review some stuff on cosmology and the effect Planck, sort of these high-scale effects in the cosmic microwave background. And I apologize to those of you who have heard this story before. So as I said, general relativity, to the extent that it works, is an effective field theory for scales larger, less than the Planck scale. And the effects of these high energy physics should be encoded in these irrelevant higher derivative operators. Now, if you write down the leading term to such a leading irrelevant operator, you find that general covariance simply always required that you had two derivatives to your theory. Therefore, the leading effect is always order sort of the momentum squared over n squared, or the e squared over n squared, which, if you think in terms of the power spectrum of inflationary density fluctuations, the momentum over a is roughly equal to the Hubble scale of inflation. So this is of size a squared over n squared.
Actually, this is the point where I vehemently disagree with that.
Yeah, can we discuss it for a minute?
Sure, because that's why we have a workshop.
In inflation,
yes.
In initial condition setup, the scales that we're interested in start out with the wavelength much smaller than the Planck length. So this parameter is not h over m squared, but it's actually bigger than m Planck over m squared. So it's huge. So it means that this whole effective action, as applied to this particular question of inflation, inflationary correlations, this effective action breaks down. So you're basically, the authors of that paper, Carlo Tegan, Lawrence, and Schenker, effectively said perturbations are generated by total radius crossing, which is completely wrong. Can you repeat
that? Okay, so
in that paper, they said, effectively, what they did is they said k over h is equal to h. And that means they've said, we start the analysis of perturbations when they cross the Hubble radius. And that's throwing the baby out of the bathwater. So in my opinion, there's one paper on the transparent problem, which is wrong. Only one paper. All the others are correct. It's that paper that's wrong.
Can I ask you to reformulate your statement? Do you mean that you cannot be effective theorists giving rise to leading order effect that is k over am without the square? This is
that's
forbidden already?
That's the point. So follow the precepts of effective action, you have to write down in terms that obey all the symmetries of the action. So the symmetry in general relativity is general covariance. That means that if you add any derivative to your theory, you must add another derivative.
No, I agree as long as we discuss about the action. What about the state of your system? Why they cannot be direction from the state?
That's where I'm going. Okay.
So you're previewing my thought.
So the leading effect of the dynamics is of order m squared. Okay. But there were many chronological toy models before this observation was made. What they simply did is they used the Hamiltonian formulation, the canonically quantized, and the idea is that the cutoff in the theory means that when the physical momentum is equal to f, there is some earliest timing again, which is different for each k. And you simply set initial conditions at that earliest time. You make use of the fact of what's known as the cosmological vacuum energy,
And when you do this in these similar water models, you need 5 leading order effects, which are linear in the small, in the new scale M. Just like your question. So, and the point is, of course, using the cosmological vacuum ambiguity, you see where we're going, and what I'm saying is this is probably, in fact, what the state of the theory is. And we'll make that explicit.
Actually, it can be even larger things, order one things.
You can get all kinds of effects, but I'm going to simply focus here on the X and Y scales. So these leading order effects are the ones that you would be the first ones to worry about in your cosmological data. Turning the question around, if can cosmological data contain signatures of new physics, the dominant effects, the linear ones, they arise from this cosmological vacuum, which is again related to this question that energy is not a conserved quantum number in a cosmological space-time. Now, this idea of using not a standard or not a bunch of Davies vacuum has been around for a long time. The reason why people have a standard vacuum is these non-standard ones have problems. Right? They are basically very difficult to square precisely with this notion of decoupling of scales. If you compute correlation functions in this non-standard state, you find all kinds of non-local terms, which tend to be non-local with the scale H. Now, in effective actions, you are allowed to get non-local terms, as long as the non-locality scale is beyond the scale of the cutoff theory. But H is lower than that scale, so you have a problem. And a more fundamental problem, in some sense, is that if you compute the back reaction in sort of these non-standard vacuum, and you subtract the usual counter term from Minkowski space, you find that this doesn't kill all the divergences. So we have a serious problem here because the UV structure of the theory shouldn't depend on what the background space-time is.
You mean that all terms deviations which are linear are excluded by the fact that all of them have this difference?
As far as I know, indeed, only the bunch Davies vacuum has this as a finite.
No, that's certainly not the case. You can take bunch Davies plus a finite amount of particles. It will be, the difference will be equally fine because you have finite stuff on the bunch Davies, on the top of bunch Davies.
Maybe
it should be not far from bunch Davies, but how far can it be from bunch Davies?
Maybe you're going to do alpha vacuum?
Well, alpha vacuum in particular are infinite, but
they're back on structure. Because you see there is no k dependence, this is why it's infinite, and it's different.
Yeah.
But this is not the...
If I take bunch Davies plus a finite amount of particles, let me not pull that back, because it's bunch Davies plus a finite amount of particles. I mean, is it cheating my way out of your question?
What is back, then?
The back is the ground state of your theory. There must be some notion.
No. So you claim that any definition of the vacuum which leads to linear effect would lead to a divergence automatically?
I'll show you we can do much better than this. Okay. So, but there are many explicit examples that suggest that these vacuum are consistent after all. So can we resolve some of these questions? So let's quickly review how this usually goes. What are the effects on the power spectrum, and then I'll show you how some of these issues with non-standard vacuum can be resolved. So the idea is the computation of the power spectrum is quite straightforward. You solve the field equation in the cosmological background, and this is a second order equation that has two solutions. And the which linear combination of solutions selected, that depends on your vacuum choice for your boundary conditions. And then the power spectrum is simply given by this formula, where this is the wave, the solution, homogeneous solution to this wave. Now let us choose a basis where this coefficient b is zero if you choose the standard Pointer Davies factor. And there's a characteristic signature of some of these initial state effects, which is basically the standard sort of mode mixing if you have two different waves, so the right wing and the left wing wave. If you take a deviation away from the standard Pointer Davies mode, this always results in oscillations terms. The change in the power spectrum is proportional to Pointer Davies power spectrum times this, the real part of this function b, and b usually is the phase that depends on k. So this is exactly what Jerome described yesterday. These are these superimposed oscillations on top of the power spectrum. Now, most of these toy models that use this phenomenological approach, they had they imposed the boundary conditions at this new physics hypersurface where the physical momentum is equal to the u scale m. And what is imposed on top of that is that the symmetries that you preserve in this story are homogeneity isotropy, clearly, but you also preserve near scale invariants. And the idea being that the spectrum that we see nowadays is very close to the sitter case. So the idea was that if you go to pure the sitter, the input was that you wanted to recover scale invariant spectra. So then these reduce to these alpha like vacuum. But you can extend this then to a slow roll computation by simply letting the Hubble constant being the only part that depends on k. And we define for the power spectrum is precisely this type of function that Jerome tested in his talk yesterday. We have an oscillatory part. Now, what happens if you want to try to prove this to an effective field theory? So the observation that we make is that all these boundary conditions, so basically your choice of an initial state, can be encoded in a boundary action that you can add to your regular action. It's very simple. You start with the action, you add a boundary term. If you calculate the variations, you find that you have two equations. One is the usual field equation in the ball, and you also have a condition that only holds on the boundary. You can work through the algebra and connect this directly with the Hamiltonian approach and find that this coefficient b that I mentioned earlier is simply this combination of the boundary coupling constant and the homogeneous solutions of the field equation.
And where is this boundary?
So this boundary is, in this case, you choose a hypersurface at a fixed time. These are the initial conditions of your system. So the point is, once you have an action, you can use your effective action presets and find out that all the corrections due to new physics should be encoded in irrelevant boundary operators as well as in irrelevant bulk operators. And whereas in the bulk, as we observed before, you always found suppression of two orders in the suppression scale F, there, it's very easy to construct irrelevant operators on the boundary that have a linear suppression in the new scale M. And this is precisely, again, the idea that since what happens in the boundary action basically encodes what is the state that you're in, this is precisely a state effect, as we know. So, perspicacity we mentioned earlier. So in some sense, what this boundary effect of field theory does, it simply parameterizes your cosmological vacuum. You can just write down your arbitrary boundary action, and it simply parameterizes all the possible choices that you have. In a rather nice way, because sort of an arbitrary operator of phi will, for dimensional reasons, have some suppression scale end in the game. And you have a nice consistent expansion in a small parameter, just like in the effective actions. So one of the things that is emphasized, if you simply do this like I have done here on this slide, the only symmetries you impose are homogeneity and isotropy. You don't impose scale invariants or near scale invariants in that sense that if you reduce this to a pure sitter background,
there's no need to recover standard quantitative resource K independent change your initial conditions. And this is immediately reflected in the power spectrum. But if you compute the power spectrum for this scenario, you find that there is there are explicit factors of K aside from the factors of the Hubble. So this is a different prediction for the power spectrum.
That's because you fixed your surface at one time in a K-independent way?
Yes. Precisely.
The Hubble, what's, I don't really understand the physical idea behind it. I mean, I see mathematically that you could relate a choice of modes to a particular boundary term. But,
so the question is, what is the physics that is described?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
I could imagine also a k-dependent surface, a different boundary term for every k.
Yes.
At imposed at a different time, let's say when k is equal to, you know, the Planck mass.
So, so in principle, that is what the previous models did. The problem with the previous models is it's not easily translated in the language of an action. And so, you at this moment, you don't have once we have an action, we have a real good control over our computations. Not saying you cannot do the computations in the other languages, it's just that things become much harder. The nice part about an action is it's very convenient organizing principles for your calculations. And we will see this come up in
general.
My next point.
In general, is a scale factor at this flat boundary.
Yes.
But so there was a legislated a homogeneous.
Yeah, but we just picked some time t and for the initial.
And just trying to find
and just plan
on it. But coming back to Tenterhoin, couldn't you start out saying I want to have an action principle for each mode initially independently, or let's say when it's, so to speak, creation time would be, then yes, you would have a problem because it would be a different time for each mode. But can't you have change variables in such a way that in this new set of variables, actually this is sort of the same time?
If you know how to do it, that would be very interesting. But I don't know how to write this in a standard covariant action type formulation.
But if you just think of it in the XP plane, yes, or X eta plane, right, then having a starting time that's different for every, TK plane, right, then you have some surface at an angle. But you know, there must be coordinate transformations that make a vertical path.
But I'm not sure you can find a coordinate transformation that sets it to vertical k and time. I can start doing many things, but we want to keep the nice organized principle of the action that all the symmetries are, where as much symmetries as possible are manifest. Right. And then you can use the tools of effective field theory. If that's not the case, then it's not that we cannot do the computation, but it just then becomes computation becomes much more horrendous. So one example of it precisely is this back reaction question.
Before we do the example, can I try? If I did this procedure of imposing a cutoff at different times,
yes.
Is it a true statement that what I produce, I mean, I'm still working with your background and your coordinate system, your time in particular. Isn't it true that what I produce is still an isotropic homogeneous state?
I'm not sure I follow your question.
Well, it seems yes or no is a good answer.
Okay.
Pick one. Let's say the answer was yes. I mean, shouldn't it be then that I should be able to parameterize that state in one transparency back,
yes,
in your language somehow?
Yeah. So,
it must be that we have to do something more creative. That you've implicitly made some extra assumption.
Yeah. So, what I've given, where was it? Here. So, if I choose some Hamiltonian language, and I choose some B, which is the sort of the coefficient that tells you how much of the negative solution of the wave equation I have compared to the positive.
instead of calling the ones named at the bottom. And this is the translation between B and my coupling constant in the field theory. So if you give me your favorite Hamiltonian prescription, in particular, this one, right? I can tell you precisely what is the formal coefficient k that you get here. The problem is that this coupling constant k will be then not sort of a coupling constant in the usual sense as a number. There will be some horrible non-local expression. And you have to sort of disentangle this in a sort of local, expanded in a term of local coupling constants that you normally would write down for effect.
Okay, just understand that means that kappa became some function of k now.
Well, generically kappa is a function of k, but okay. It actually
what
is.
What
would
be different about it then?
Well, you also want, normally you want k to be roughly analytic in the momenta, if you really want to interpret this as a normal effective action. It's not because you can see from here that generically it will not be an analytic function.
So this other choice gave you non-analytic functions. But you're saying if I made some small k expansion, I could expand it, and what would I be producing? A higher order expansion
yes.
of irrelevant
yes.
operators.
Yes. I mean, k is roughly the spatial momenta, and on this boundary action, spatial momenta is all that you have roughly. So it's very well. So,
but I guess the problem would be that it's really to get this boundary condition that other people like.
Yeah.
You would have to resum the infinite series,
yes.
And so it's not natural
precisely.
From your perspective.
Precisely.
But implicitly, it is something one could do if one
yeah.
really went into that approach.
So this is what in some sense, this is what I tried to mention before to Akis. I mean, you can do all this in Hamiltonian, which is the effective action is a nice organizing principle for your calculations. And this is the translation back and forth.
Right, but what it points to me is that it in some sense, it prejudices your point of view. I mean, it's a nice organizing
yes.
principle, but it's not clear it's the right physics. And it prejudices you to think about certain sets of boundaries.
No, you're correct. You're completely correct. I will show you in a moment that this indeed has these problems in a more explicit way.
It troubles me very much the appearance of A0. I don't understand what this parameter means. Is it some, it's scale factor at some time where you think that the universe has become sufficiently well organized that macroscopic and relativistic physics that we use it is correct,
yes.
And that everything thereafter that you're predicting that flows out of this time without any further doctoring up of making more moles and seeing other
yes.
conditions by the subsequent expansion from this point A0.
That's implicitly the effect of action.
That's
sure.
pretty strong.
So the idea behind the effect of action
is
that
questionable that I agree, it's very questionable that physics works that way. Because you would think that every, all along during inflationary periods, such things which are being generated that go
only
at one particular origin of time.
For the sake of progress in this talk, as you see, there are many issues with this proposal. Okay, and in fact, in a moment, I will show you a more serious issue, which tells you that seems to be a consistent framework, but it certainly doesn't describe the physics.
Just to be explicit, are you considering all momenta on that initial surface, or all momenta up to a certain ubiquity?
After the cutoff, that's always the
effect. So this cutoff will happen.
Okay, but what again? Yes.
Maybe to respond to Robert, if you have this space-like hypersurface on which we set up an initial state,
yes.
then if you look at a fixed momentum, you should expect that the result will depend on A sub zero, because you have different amounts of redshifting of this junk that you have.
Yes.
So I think the A0 doesn't have a problem.
No, it doesn't have a problem.
Okay, I mean, I can talk for half an hour about this question, but I'm not going to do it. Because I'll take the general message that we know, which is that there are issues with this, and there are. But there are also benefits to it, and that I also want to point out, because this is precisely why you want effective actions. Is that this question, for instance, this question of back reaction. If you choose a non-standard initial state, is the back reaction naively divergent? But in this effective action, you can use all the tools of normalization theory to show, in fact, that for any of these new boundary couplings where kappa really is a coefficient in your action, the back reaction is controlled, under control. And the reason is that you have a new coupling constant in your action, which can reabsorb the naive divergence that you had before. And so this is an advantage of this effective action formulation. In the Hamiltonian formulation as the initial state, it was not obvious that there was a way to reabsorb these divergences. Now that you know there is, you can go back to the Hamiltonian formalism and do Hamiltonian normalization. But this tells you exactly how that issue can be resolved. So none of these states have additional, all these states are completely finite, you can normalize them in the back reaction. And maybe actually Hale at the next talk will give some examples. He's been working this out in detail. Okay, so now I want to point out the problem that that we encountered, which is related to all these issues that you raised. If you want to now use this as your template to measure the cosmological data, you find that because there are two different symmetries that you have imposed, you have imposed near scale invariance here, but not here, there's different behavior of the corrections to power spectrum. In particular, the power spectrum for the effective field theory has a linear term in the momentum, whereas the power spectrum for sort of this new physics hypersurface is not linear in the momentum. And the good part is that for all these models, as for many other models, including the dispersion relation models that were also mentioned earlier in this conference, is there are sort of reasonable ranges of the parameters for their observable effects. So this is really a worthwhile study. But the problem is that because the power spectrum grows with k, actually what happens is, so these are some plots where you can actually show precisely how power spectrum changes. But I wanted to go here. This is a study by Richard Easterbrook and Hiranya Harris. You find that it's not sort of in the CME range that the major effect of these initial state boundary effective field theory. But for the stuff that grows with k, the largest effects are really at the very, very high end in k range. And this is not measured by the CMP, but this is measured by large scale structure survey experiments. And this is related to this issue that I mentioned very much at the beginning. In cosmology, actually, early times correspond to large states, but it's late times correspond to small scales. So small scales are high k. Spatial k is stuff that you measure in late time cosmology when you already have structure formation. And this is a problem, and then it basically means is that what we're seeing here is certainly not the the universe that we try to measure. So it looks like a completely consistent framework, but it's not the physics that we expect of the universe as we describe. So just to shortcut is that are these quantum gravity contributions or these first order corrections decided from cosmological data? Well, so as I said before, almost all of these models have reasonable ranges of parameters for their effects that are decided from future experiments. So this is really a very good question, an interesting question to tackle. Now, this phenomenological approach is intuitively very sensible. But in terms of sort of a consistent approach where you can answer all these questions like back reaction, it's very difficult. It may not be impossible, but it's not sort of the nicest way to look at things.
On the other hand, we have this boundary action proposal, which is theoretically controlled, but it doesn't seem to describe the physics of the universe that we want to see. So what we really would like is, as many of you pointed out, we want some kind of best of both universe approach. We want some effective field theory that has all the theoretical computational control, but that in some sense imposes initial conditions on this new physics hypersurface. This is, well, in progress by myself and many other people. This is really what we should aim for.
What does that mean, though? Well, that you'll still have a boundary term in the effective action? You'll also have other effects?
There are many effects. So I mentioned before, there are many of these issues in the effective actions for gravity. Right? If the background space-time changes, you're also basically assuming that that changes adiabatic. So, for instance, we know that if you use the Planck steady state, you don't get some of these issues like divergent back reaction. So that seems to also work. Okay. But again, you can think of deviations of the bunch that you state. In the same way that the ideal behind effective actions is that you identify this small parameter and write down a consistent quantitative expansion of the small parameter. So that's really the idea that I want to move forward, is that for all these issues when energy is no longer a conserved quantum number, you should again sort of revisit the story. What is the conserved quantum number? And what is the small parameter? And write down an action that is a series of small parameters so that you can do it order by order and quantitative. And that should, in principle, if you think of bunch babies as the adiabatic state where everything works, right? Because of this deviations from the initial state should be interpreted in that small parameter and not in terms of deviations from this boundary. There may be some boundary-like term, but it will not be a boundary in the spatial space-time sense. Okay. So there's one thing that I want to mention before I move on to the second topic, which is not unrelated, but very different, is that as Rob mentioned at the very beginning, h of inflation can be very small. And then there's no hope measuring this. And one of the reasons, there's actually a second complication, that at least the spatial curvature fluctuations, or ones that are directly related to the temperature fluctuations in B that we measure, they have an extra parameter in the amplitude, which is this little rho parameter. So it's actually this combination here that we know support 10 to the minus 5. This is the 10 to the minus 10 in the unit standard. This is the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. This is the amplitude that is measured. So, but if we were to measure primordial gravitational waves, many people have pointed out, is that there is not longer this suppression by the slow roll parameter, which if this is very small or large, change H fairly, it doesn't have the suppression, so it measures the scale of inflation directly. And in fact, in order to measure primordial gravitational waves, the scale of inflation has to be rather large. Otherwise, we won't observe them. They are not yet observed. But the point is that there seems to be a very nice correlation with sort of the detection range of primordial gravitational waves and the accuracy of the corrections to the spatial curvature fluctuations. Which means that you can make this rough statement that if you see primordial gravitational waves, this is a very good indication that you should explicitly search for these corrections to spatial temperature fluctuations because they are physically important. So there is basically an experimental signature that should really tell you whether this is something that you have to worry about or that you can ignore. Now I want to talk about...
Before we go then.
Yes.
So you want to comment on how likely that is in the near future?
How likely one can measure gravitational waves?
Yeah.
I have no idea. If the scale of inflation is low, we won't see them. I mean, I cannot estimate that likelihood.
Right, but I don't know, maybe Gustin or someone, what experimental efforts are being made in that direction?
Many.
So, is it something I'm going to hear about in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
if you go to any experimental cosmology talk right now, this will almost certainly be mentioned. So what this is related to is so the latest WMAP data measured polarization, sort of it's called the e-polarization parameter. So you can show that these gravitational waves are sort of the B of polarization, the other polarization. It's very sensitive to the gravitational waves. And this is sort of the next big effort. The problem is that these B mode polarizations are A, suppressed compared to the E mode polarizations, and B, have very large foreground and many other effects. So to actually decipher it from the data will be a big task. But this is precisely what we know both in telescopes as well as sort of the Planck satellite. Well, although Planck was not a dedicated satellite for that issue.
But yes. But isn't it fair to say that the hope that Planck will give us a good spectrum of harmonic gravitational waves is very limited? I mean, getting signatures such as those from Planck, I don't think is very likely.
Which signatures
such as small oscillations on top of
that we will not be able to get. But what it will tell you is the scale of inflation.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is that this. So if you see them, you should look at the temperature fluctuations for small parameter. You won't see them in the gravitational waves, even though they're there. The accuracy will never be high, good enough. Roughly speaking, also because you have cosmic variance to deal with. So, and it's precisely at the small scales where cosmic variance is lowest that the foreground issues for gravitational waves are the largest. So, there's this narrow sort of in between the cosmic variance error and the foreground error that you have the less chance of detecting these beams.
So, what's the status with direct detection of rotational waves? I mean, if LISA gets off the ground, and you mentioned all sorts of things, is it considerable that we might?
I think I'm not an expert on this, but I think LISA has the potential to see primordial gravitational waves as well.
But then that's why the issue is even worse, because we're sensitive to all merging binaries in the universe, essentially.
And LISA is a directional
yeah,
test.
It's highly resolved, then.
Nevertheless,
yeah.
So many on your life.
It's a stochastic background. It's a stochastic background from the.
But yeah, two pieces.
It's the wrong frequency. You want to look really well frequencies because you want to shift it from the back.
So, and to finally answer your question, I mean, at some point before we were going to Mars, there was on the drawing table at NASA CMB pole, which was a satellite which was basically dedicated to detecting the polarization of the microwave background, including the B modes.
Right.
So if have somebody have a sense that's more important than going to Mars, that will be built.
But there are other experiments too. I mean, there's a several of the like Atacama desert
yep.
experiments will be looking at this.
Yep.
Planck can't do anything like this. The B mode polarization detection in Planck is not much better than WMAP 3. But a lot of the smaller scale balloon and high altitude things are going to be stepping down the limits over the next 5 years.
So
5 years before you get some meaningful limits, actual measurements, you know, but it'll be mainly limits. But they're getting into the range where it's interesting soon.
So they're really doing it.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty longer term. I mean, direct detection, is it out of the question? Are you saying the frequency ranges of
something like these things? It's not really. Well, because they're looking like, well, the problem is that something like this is looking mainly for like these bursts, or you have to have a template catch. And so, for a stochastic background, it's just a pop. And so, I think disentangling the stochastic background from astrophysical sources and cosmological background would be hard. I mean, I know that people worry about it, but I don't know much about that.
So, if you had limited amounts of study, then how would you go about measuring it directly?
Oh, I think you have to see it indirectly. I mean, I think that the indirect in the CMB is much better for the cosmological source. I mean, for the Big Bang, you want to see them in the CMB because that's when they're interesting and strong.
But there may be some foreground.
Oh yeah, there's bad foregrounds there, but they're better. But they're better than the rest of the universe between us and them.
I mean, if the scale of inflation is high enough, I mean, people have done simulations, they will see. Right?
Oh yeah.
So
oh yeah.
That's a guarantee.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a big range where there's actually interesting to see. There's a big range where there's not, but
yeah,
you can say meaningful things.
Well, the point is that the scale of inflation is on the term.
Sure.
This will set this. If you see this, it will set the scale of inflation,
and then you're saying it's interesting to do
yes.
more. Can I ask you to go back to the large scale structure graph? Yeah, so I'm looking at that, and I've seen huge error bars, and yet you're saying something is being ruled out.
Oh, okay. So these are the error bars are only for the slow digital sky survey. So, for instance, here you see the CFB and the error bars basically won't fit on this line. Except, of course, at the end, so the CFB, you know, the errors start increasing as you go to smaller scales. And then at this low end, that's called the variance. And I'm not the reactor, but I think this is already an outdated data set, so the errors are smaller. Actually, strictly speaking, if you do the strict analysis of the Sterkinian variance, it's just not ruled out. So as you can see, the errors are still large enough that you can see all these wiggles. So this is basically the most, what they've plotted here is the corrections due to sort of this boundary coupling constant that is still allowed by the CMB. And then wanted to see whether a slow digital sky ray can rule that out. So that's not true at this moment in the data. But
okay,
so there are very tiny error bars here due to CMB experiments, which you can't see because this line is very big. So what they simply took is, let us now draw the largest correction according to this boundary effective field theory scenario that is still allowed with the consistent with the CMB errors. And see how it affects the large scale structure. And see, maybe this large scale structure rules that already out. Maybe it's a stronger constraint than the CFB data itself.
What about the first star formation? Because as you see, the fluctuation, that is the deviation with respect to the standard work. So, where they will certainly have a dramatic effect. Much smaller scale.
At some point, you go beyond the linear.
No, in the early universe, it was linear. Today it's non-linear.
This
growth, the linear growth of the very small fluctuation, that is deviation, would be completely modified by the scenario.
Right. This is how matter power spectrum is modified.
At much smaller scale, look, the deviation you are predicting are growing with the momentum.
Yes.
That is growing when the scale are becoming smaller. So you expect or you predict much larger deviation at small scales. Those small scales have been linear initially. And so since they are now larger deviation, their linear growth, if they are present because of the deviation, would be really modified. And the formation of the first star should have been completely dramatically affected because there is, in your prediction, a linear growth of the deviation in K.
Actually, I don't think it's so easy because you see, once a large scale goes non-linear, it's going to be fragmentation and power is going to very rapidly seep down to the small scales.
So, do you accept that you can have a primordial spectrum wherein you have a linear growth in the deviation and that would have no effect on any cosmological?
I think the strongest bounds, I may be wrong, but I think it's the strongest bounds on the blueness of the spectrum are still from primordial black hole formation, and this may be true here as well.
Okay.
And then you don't have any fragmentation effects. This is a very simple scenario. So just by demanding that primordial black holes do not overclose the universe, you get a pretty strong bound on the blueness of the spectrum. And that also applies to the wiggles in the spectrum.
Oh, yes, what I said was true for a red spectrum, not for blue spectrum.
No. A blue spectrum is a blue deviation.
That's
not accepted. Simply ruled out. Already ruled out.
Okay. So
not in these experiments.
So this is not strictly blue, but I mean, the growth of K is a serious problem. I mean, that's what I've been pointing out.
It's ruled out. It's not a problem. It's ruled out.
Okay, so from the theoretical point of view.
So you said it's just acceptable according to this, but you're saying there are other growths, star formation.
In our universe.
If you go to arbitrarily small scale.
Right, to the right of this the end of the graph here.
Right, because
and they're going to
thermodynamic fluctuation exists at all scales, so they influence all processes, not only the one we can still observe today in the kind of linear regime.
That's true.
And the stars and everything was
based on the session chair. I think I'll just pipe up for 1 second and say that, sticking on the schedule, we have 25 minutes roughly left. I wanted to make sure you're aware of that.
I am.
In terms of what you want to cover, and this is obviously stimulating a lot of interest, but...
So, yeah, so let me go on, because I want to take a different task. But I want you to take from this basically what everyone is saying, is that this is not yet the work that we can actually use, but one has to make first progress. So let me now go to a different aspect. We've talked about high-skill physics, so let me now talk about low-skill physics, which is work with Justin Couriel. So again, the idea is I want to use effective actions, because the physics question is always what is the relevant scale, and effective actions are a convenient organized tool to figure out what is the relevant physics at that scale. It's a very convenient way to compare theory to experiment. So now in gravity, we know is in the field theory, and we actually know gravity and what are the scales that you should consider. Well, we know with the lambda CGM concordance model, we know gravity up to the scales of the Hubble constant take down to 1 millimeter, and that theory works really, really well. There are two obscure ingredients, many of you know, dark energy and dark matter, which are very important. And there's lots of evidence for these. Let's take time, let me not go over it. But there are many people who've tried to figure out whether maybe, if you just look at standard GR, what is the range over which standard GR, that means without dark energy and dark matter, it's a slightly smaller scale, it only works from 1 millimeter up to galactic scale. Basically, this is when the dark matter starts to become important. So what people have been trying to do is try to modify gravity in the infrared to account for the observations beyond galactic scales. Now, there are many other proposals. I'm not going to go through all details. There is the Mond proposal, which was phenomenologically rather successful until very recently, as most of you know. There are some brain world inspired scenarios called the DGP scenario, and there's the Higgs gravity. Roughly speaking, they have the following actions. And you can integrate out the extra degrees of freedom to find out the modifications in infrared. And the point is that all these different IR scales should reduce to general relativity for the scale R, which is less than the galactic scale. So indeed, sort of schematically, all these theories are GR plus some infrared scale over R plus some infrared scale squared over R. And the idea is, can you lift this to an action? In other way, can you conveniently organize all these proposals in some effective action scenario? And this would tell you something about the infrared structure of gravity. Now, there are many questions that are raised. I mean, sort of what is the a nice cutoff scale that you should think about? Is it the Hubble radius today, or is it the horizon, which is both related? At the end of the day, of course, physics should be independent of whatever you choose for the cutoff scale, and is there some infrared notion of the normalization group? There's one very interesting aspect, and this is the mention shortly, which is the one that I asked you to keep in mind earlier, is that in these gravity gauge theory developments, it's precisely sort of the UV structure of gauge theory where there is a nice organizing principle like this, which is mapped to the IR structure in gravity. So this could be one type of inspiration why we should do this. Of course, the gravity gauge gravities are only well understood for theories with a negative cosmological constant, and you might wonder whether it even works for zero positive cosmological constant. So the point is that what I want to make is that this is not a completely crazy idea.
If you follow one of the ways you can construct effective actions, which is sort of implementing the Wilsonian or normalization rule a la Kuczynski, which is in very simple models, you can explicitly integrate out the degrees of freedom that you have to construct the effective action. And you do that by picking an arbitrary separation scale, lambda, between the degrees of freedom that you want to integrate out and the degrees of freedom that you want to keep. And you simply demand that physics doesn't depend on this arbitrary computation scale. You find an equation for the effective action, which is as follows. The holding written in the so-called classical part. And you can reinterpret this in terms of sort of the normal normalization flow in field theory. So the point is that at this moment, I have not told you on purpose whether this field phi that you keep is a UV or an IR excitation. And the point is that the mathematics that you do is indeed completely independent of which are the degrees of freedom that you rule out. The only difference is you have to do is you have to choose your cutoff function in your theory, which is given by G here, which is the propagator, appropriately such that you cut off the right modes.
So is it all in the Euclidean sector or the reflexive one?
So one of the subtleties of effective field theory, which is which I haven't mentioned today, but I actually mentioned during the talk last afternoon, is the fact that field theory is really only nullifying in the Euclidean setting.
Well, how would you accommodate cosmology?
So you have to basically appeal to analytic continuation from Minkowski to Euclidean and back.
In cosmology, I said.
Yes.
With A of T, what is an Euclidean? How can you Euclideanize A of T? As long as A of T is a constant, now with in inflation, A of T is a, I don't know, a scalar function.
Yes.
A of T in the Euclidean sector would be a complex function.
Yes.
Okay, it could be, I don't know, if it's even
more. Well, it's not pure computer sector, and of course, happens to work. But, right, pure sector, this is a sphere.
It's scaling by, so to
speak. I mean, no, this is a serious issue. I mean, I don't want to ignore it, but the only thing I can do is appeal to try to do effective actions, which you know work in the field theory, and hope that it works most.
Can you kind of, again, explain why you need to do the Euclidean theory?
So some of these steps here are mathematically only nullifying if you have a Euclidean, Laplacian, false. You write basically functions of false, which in flat space are only well-defined, you have a good behavior, you have Euclidean signature. So you really want to do many of these manipulations, certain terms you have to argue are both to zero. And that's basically because e to the minus, e to the sort of plus box goes to zero for I, k. And so if you have a light bulb where there are many large momenta or it doesn't occur, you can't argue that.
So this is to show us that there's an effective flow to the ultraviolet.
Yes.
Which is something like a fixed point.
Well, a fixed point, I don't know.
Fixed flow, anyway.
That's a good question. That's a good
flow.
A
congruence of flows to give us some universality in the extreme ultraviolet.
Some of the early motivations that I mentioned, so that gravity, the UV completion, seems to be unique, made the indication that I have no concrete statements about this.
Well,
I only know that someone is qualitative
ranking for.
Excuse me?
I don't know what you're ranking for.
Okay, so what I'm aiming for.
I see the title. Why will the effective action produces?
Yeah.
It would be very nice, because then if we think that the universe begins from
the. So why it would exist is because the mathematical steps that you do along the way, right? Don't make any distinction between whether you call stuff UV or you call stuff IR. The only thing that changes is what you use as the cutoff function that separates.
It's surprising because, I mean, as you know, in gauge theory, in non-Euclidean gauge theory, we have an effective flow that washes up and down to free. And that's wonderful. And here you have kind of an anti-asymptotically free theory, and you're aiming to get useful information from.
Well, gravity is infrared free, so in this sense,
from the ultraviolet flow, but the rather surprising as a program.
Anyway, so Yes.
Sorry.
Sure.
But so I think where we're going is we're going to integrate out
infrared
degrees of freedom, but you want to express the physics in terms of an action principle. And I guess what I'm worried about is if I'm thinking about some interesting physics system, and it can lose energy, though, into these infrared degrees of freedom, that you get dissipative effects that I'm not sure I would describe or be able to describe.
So that's very good. So in related to a question that was raised earlier, is when you do this, you find that you get a lot of non-local operators, which is the idea that you support is you have integrated out degrees of freedom that where energy can flow into.
Mm-hmm.
And the normal you get it included. I mean, this is not a very difficult observation. If you have a normal infrared effect action, you have an expansion in the momenta over lambda squared, but then in a UV effect action, you have, roughly speaking, the opposite expansion. Zero momenta are the guys that are killed, so you have a lambda squared over Fox expansion. And in terms of the effect of action, all these terms are non-local. So you have a big problem is that in a red effect of action, you can set all the UV sources of sinks to zero, which is basically related to energy conservation. It means that if you have any process, you won't create any of these modes. But in a UV effect of action, you know, as Rob has said, that you do continuously create these modes. You have basically soft emission. Now, there's a possible solution, which has been in some of the literature has been at least qualitatively proposed, which I just want to mention, is that if you have an infrared effect of action, you can think of this as a lattice gradient in X space. And basically, what you do is you discretize the spatial coordinate. Now, the way you can account for all these soft sort of particles, or these small momenta particles, in the standard field theory, is you actually have to include these all in your final space. If you have the way it usually works is your detector has a resolution, which also is not sensitive to infinitely small differences in energy, you have to basically sum over that range of the resolution. And you do that, have to do it coherently. Effectively, what it means is you discretize your momentum in your theory. And so this is a possible solution where I don't have any concrete proposals, but it has many of the qualitative features that you want. For instance, discretizing P, you also get that very easily by putting stuff in finite volume, which is the response to the use of thought of, which is precisely what we're doing here. So given these problems, you might say, well, okay, you can stop here. Well, we decided to simply go on and see what you would get. It's, you can write down following these precepts and equation for gravity, and you do get some interesting results. If I can ignore this last term, I won't go into details, but if I just write down this renormalization group equation, what we find is that the solution to the action took the following form. You get just the standard Einstein-Hilbert term as the leading term, of course, and this is the first leading correction. Now, one thing I want to emphasize is that at this moment I have only integrated out infrared degrees of freedom in pure GR. So this theory still describes pure GR. I have not changed my theory at all.
Sorry, I don't understand. How come there is no imaginary term to the effective one action or whatever the effective action?
No,
precisely because there is dissipation.
Well, strictly speaking, right, box. You want to define it precisely in field theory as an imaginary part, right? Because you have to.
I mean, the finite, not covered by epsilon.
The finite?
That is, the imaginary part of this effective action should contain finite imaginary parts, not controlled by epsilon, controlled by the emission rate.
That's a good question to which I don't have an immediate answer. Except that if I only consider sort of finite ranges of people, and then I pull that sort of my space, then within that sector nothing happens. But that's a good question to which I don't know. Okay, so the point is that what you find is that actually your naive expectation is not realized. Right? So naively you would guess that you write down all operators, with respect to the symmetries up to the order that you consider, which would be something like this. And there are three possible ones, and one that doesn't appear, and then we have a very precise condition, two. Now, that's, of course, the point is that for if you have a specific theory, right, then, of course, you get very specific coefficients for alpha, beta, and gamma. But one point is that there is a very long-run observation, which, in terms of this infrared effect action, corresponds to the statement that there are good theories are theories which describe general relativity are theories which have alpha equal minus gamma over 2 and epsilon is 0. And the reason is you can show, if you translate now this back into field equations, that these are the theories where you have no van Damme-Feldman-Sakharov discontinuity. Or in other words, the number of propagating degrees of freedom that you have in your theory has stayed the same. Now this seems to go beyond sort of the usual symmetry requirements that if you because just symmetry requirements tell you to write something down like this. Which is an interesting observation that maybe symmetry is not enough if you want to do this. Now there's a second interesting observation, is that you can actually integrate this irrelevant operator up to order r squared, so including all corrections.
Did you get a result like this? Are you integrating out matter fields?
I'm integrating out the law. I started with pure GR, so I don't have any matter. And I'm integrating out all the modes that are less than some energy. The point is, what you find if you compute the equations of motions for this theory is the following modified Einstein equation. You have here this cutoff function f times the Einstein sensor times t mu nu. And this has appeared in the literature before as a completely ad hoc proposal to the solution for the cosmological constant. Remember, this is a function that kills all infrared modes in my theory. In particular, the dominant, there's only one of these modes, one mode couples to the cosmological constant, and that's the purely constant mode of gravity, which you have integrated out. So if you have a function that cuts off all infrared modes, it means that the cosmological constant in such a theory does not gravitate. It's there, but it doesn't gravitate. So this was an ad hoc proposal that was proposed a number of years ago. And here you see it come out of and sort of at least attempt to a consistent action proposal. So this was a rather interesting observation. Now you can start doing some more exercises. The point is, of course, that all these different IR extensions that have been proposed, if they are in some way consistent, should correspond to different coefficients of these irrelevant operators. And for instance, for the DGP scenario, which actually has sort of three phases, so I'm not going to discuss true for these cases, it has a phase where there is four-dimensional gravity plus a scalar, you find that the coefficients are as follows. We need to note that alpha is not minus gamma over 2, so there is a Van Damme-Feldman-Sakharov continuity, but that actually simply is just a scalar mode that you have extra. They do have a problem is that if you look at many of their papers, their cutoff function is non-analytic. Momenta. So again, there are many issues with these infrared differing scenarios for gravity. And it's not so hard to figure out what happens to Mond or Higgs gravity because you can write them as standard actions that you just integrate out the extra degree of freedom aside from gravity. Now, I just want to make two more observations because I'm also running out of time. This IR cutoff, right, seems to screen the cosmological constant. Remember, of course, in the effective action, I've arbitrarily integrated out the infrared modes. But all the physics in the should stay the same within the range of scales that I'm actually measuring. So somewhere in our the fact that you don't physically see in the equations the gravity and the cosmological constant should still be hidden in the equations. So many of these solutions where you have extra terms or extra curvature terms in the action have self-gravitating solutions. For instance, there has been a lot of work on the cosmology of the DGP model, which is which has following correction to the standard zero-zero component of the Einstein equation. There are problems with this. So this is a story of problems. It turns out that if this doesn't really work, because this is not a few equation of the DGP model, you have chosen the wrong sign of a root here. But anyway, the point is that this, in principle, this should work. So, and there you can do the same thing with observational constraints. So, what you can try to do is, again, you use this effective action. And in the normal way of effective actions, you use observation to constrain the numbers alpha, gamma, and epsilon. And this can tell you, this can differentiate between all these various proposals of infrared physics, provided that they are consistent in the sense that they can capture by this infrared effective action. If they can't, you basically know from the first that you have a serious problem. So there are many open questions here. As I said, at almost every slide I mentioned to you a problem. But there are also many interesting observations, so it's not an unworthwhile exercise. Is such an UV effective action truly consistent? Has to be the ultimate question of the whole. And so the question of locality of your terms in the action is very important. As I said, if you really use sphere wave functions, there may be a solution to this. But is there some universal behavior? This was also mentioned. Do you really, within the space, all theories flow to a subset? The reason why this might be interesting is precisely because of the non-uniqueness of infrared completions of gravity. This may be a trivial statement. You can always add infinite numbers of massless scalar fields, and integrating them out would give different infrared conditions of gravity. But there is some indication that from gauge gravity duality, that this is again an interesting exercise. However, it's not known how this would work on long spaces without a cosmological constant. But again, a positive point may be that if this works, it would unify lots of these open ideas in a universal physical constant. Again, this, to me, makes it worthwhile to pursue any of these bond-like theories or IR modifications. The first thing that you propose, your new favorite one, would be, if this whole idea of an infrared effective action work, to see if you can reduce it to one of these effective actions. And then you can use the whole machine or that compared to experiment with that. And it explains also some ideas in the literature. So, to conclude, because I think I'm exactly 1 minute left, if there are questions you have, you can always ask me later. Consistent effective actions frameworks for gravity are still lacking. That would be the main message that I want to say to you, either from the UV or the infrared. And although there are many indications on both sides, that something like this should exist. And the main point is that as the data improves that we are gathering, some of these effective actions necessarily may be useful work, but would certainly be extremely convenient to have, because it gives you a real good theoretical control over the errors of whatever small parameters that you neglect. Thank you very much.
So we're 20 minutes till the end of the coffee break, but I think we should entertain a few short questions. Try to keep it brief, please.
I don't understand why, if an infrared cutoff screens the cosmological constant, why doesn't it screen any homogeneous and isotropic source? How come you end up with the same?
Yeah, it screens anything that has principal structure.
It screens the expansion of the
universe. It screens the expansion of the universe, yes.
So, standard cosmology, why did you end up with only a small correction to standard cosmology then? Or, if, no, that was the GDP.
Yes.
So, if this F inverse V mu nu equals mu nu, if that's really true, then you don't get any
standard. You don't get cosmology in the standard sense, but remember, the whole idea of effective actions, right, is it simply recasts all the physics in a different set of variables. So all the usual sort of anything that we see within our scales, the scale of looking better, should in some way or another come back out of the equations. Only in the recognizable form of cosmological constant and whatever. But at the end of the day, you should find that the solution for the metric within the range that we see is that of an expanding universe.
Right. I suppose the difference between cosmological constant and other homogeneous fluid is that the cosmological constant is homogeneous in space and also time.
Okay. That's so what I...
Whereas a normal thing does not evolve rapidly on a Hubble time, the Hubble constant doesn't.
Yeah, that's correct.
I have a question about, effective field theory applied to cosmology. Since there is a preferred time direction, roughly speaking, in the cosmos, the natural question to ask whether you should be considering effective field theories that break diffeomorphism invariance in the sense of making use of a preferred time-like vector field. So if you did that, really my question is, for example, let's be very specific. So this argument from Stanford that the lowest order term in the effective action would be fourth order in derivatives. Well, if I can make use of a unit vector field, time-like vector, in the effective action, can I change that conclusion? And if so, should I be considering effective actions that do refer to this preferred time field?
I think qualitatively the answer to your question is yes. So why do I think that is, as I tried to say in the first couple of slides, is when you are in this non-standard situation, basically gravity, or you have an expanding space-time, people always make the adiabatic approximation, or some approximation which has a small parameter. But unlike with the rest of effective action, you don't write down a controlled expansion in this effective parameter. Mm-hmm. But at least this effective parameter will have be something like the frequency, the derivative of the frequency of the frequency squared. And that will include the time derivative. That will include this vector.
Right.
And if you write down an expansion in terms of these non-adiabatic parameters, you should get this vector back, because if you insist that there's no time evolution, it should disappear.
Right.
So I think qualitatively the answer is how it precisely will feature in.
It also seems like you could deal with, you mentioned that it's difficult to formulate the effective action methods precisely with Lorentzian signature.
Yes.
But that would also be ameliorated if you could make use of if there's a timeline vector field with respect to which you can define the scales that you're separating in your effective action.
That I don't really see.
Well, because then you can just, for example, you could use an energy scale, and it's a preferred energy because it's preferred time direction or preferred momentum. So you've got a well-defined control. So it seems to me, and then I guess I'd just like to point out, it doesn't have to be dynamically inconsistent. I've been, and many other people have been working for a while on a generally covariant modification of general relativity where there exists a time-like vector field. It seems to be a fairly benign piece of structure to add into the space-time, it turns out, at least if you choose the right Lagrangian. So that just to formulate the technical question, can we even mess around with such an effective action without ruining everything we already need, I think the answer might be yes, we can. So maybe if you really want to insist, it seems like a good idea to pursue effective action methods, but this, I'm suggesting that including this time field that can link the terms you could write in the action to the fact that the cosmos is expanding might be a way to go.
Well, I agree. I don't know how to do it explicitly, otherwise I'm sure. I think that is the
case. Basically, wouldn't be the point that in the effective action, you expect all sorts of terms that are of a symmetry. Now, if you break your symmetry, you allow more terms, in particular, the order.
Right, exactly.
But it it seems crucial that when you started to explain why it is that you need a Euclidean signature there, and you started to explain that somehow the light cone would mess things up.
Okay,
you didn't carry that argument to the end.
So this is. Let me give you the simplest explanation just for time. I mean, it's not completely 100%, but roughly what you have to do is you have to make the path integral well defined to make the separation between fields. So you have the path integral one half of fields, and then you have this cutoff function f inverse box f, and there's some scale here lambda squared. What you really want to do is you want to make sure that the action, right, is infinite, or basically that f goes to, strictly goes to zero, very high modulus lambda squared. The point is that only really makes sense in Euclidean space where the box is a negative definite, semi-definite operator, and in Minkowski space, that's really the issue. Is that if you want to then use standard Gaussian integral techniques, if you base that out, you really want to, you need this condition.
Well, that much is clear, but how is it connected to having a clean separation of scales? Is that what you say, that you need the separation of the scales, or for what purpose do you need?
Because you could have small blocks with arbitrarily high energy, for example.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. I see.
You can do a Hamiltonian wise and to just write that the modes with respect to the degrees of freedom that you want to integrate out. So they're interacting with the degrees of freedom you want to keep in, and just eliminate those modes and the energy of those modes to get an effective Hamiltonian among the modes you want, and you don't have to mess around with what you mean by the calibration.
But again, that selects a preferred time direction.
Right, so I wanted to make one comment because
this will be the last comment because we need some coffee, I think.
My fancy a little bit. If you continue your free association with effective actions and you get an R and an R squared, then you can look for stationary solutions of that. And you can easily get inflation if the signs work out. H squared is equal to H4, and H is of order 1, the scale that you put in. And so that would be your effective ultraviolet inflating system, but it inflates. And so it rapidly is going to pop into the infrared degrees of freedom, which is actually ignored by integrating them out. And so one wonders if you do it carefully. If you are free associated, I can free associate also, when this effective action starts to lose its utility because you bump into really important physical effective degrees of freedom that you shouldn't integrate out. Because you're really seeing the physical effects that you can see the end of inflation.
This is the main problem. It's implicit in this locality problem.
I mean, it would be a way of trying to understand how you could
for the engines. That is the big problem.
Okay, let's thank you, Robert.
Thank you.